Hey guys, this is the Road to Medical Sales podcast brought to you by Legacy Now Coaching. Make sure to please press that subscribe button, rate us, and leave us a review so that we can continue to grow and impact as many lives as possible. Today, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Christopher Wolter. We have previously only had one surgeon on the podcast. I wanted to bring on Dr. Wolter because gaining the perspective of an academic practice surgeon is incredibly important to sales reps for many reasons, which I plan on unpacking in this episode. Dr. Wolter is a double board certified urologist with a fellowship in female pelvic health and reconstructive surgery. Dr. Wolter received his Bachelor's of Science degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He completed his medical degree at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Rockford, in both his general surgery internship and his residency at Tulane University School of Medicine. Finally, went on to complete his fellowship at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Currently, Dr. Wolter is the residency program director and Director of Urology Education at a prominent academic institution in Arizona. Outside of his professional career, Dr. Wolter is married with two sons and has also held two Guinness Book of World Records. I have had the great privilege of supporting Dr. Wolter in the OR, and while he is an incredibly gifted surgeon, he is also an extremely genuine and refreshing person to be around. With all that being said, Dr. Wolter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's really a pleasure to be on here with you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the time. I know how busy you are.
Thank you.
So let's just dive right in. Being an academic practice physician, explain to our listeners what you think are the major differences between private practice and academic institutions.
I think there's several key differences. I mean, for one, you know, I'm a urologist, and so we all, you know, are basically treating the same disease processes. I think, those of us who are at academic institutions, I think the expectation is that we are oftentimes the last stop for patients. And so, you know, a lot of this is, you know, you have to kind of take whatever comes through the door. There's no referring out, and you're there because of the support that we get at an academic institution with a residency program and with fellowship programs there. As complex and as hard as a patient can be to take care of, we are there for our colleagues in the community to handle, you know, kind of the worst if we need to. That's the 30,000 foot view of it. But, you know, in other regards, I think us as academicians, we're, you know, largely salaried. I would say that our motivations and our kind of reasons for what we're doing are often very specific to our chosen subfields within, in my case, urology. So for example, you and I worked together in your past life as a prosthetics rep. So, you know, we do penile implants and incontinence surgery. That's my main focus of my practice. I really, you know, don't see prostate cancer or kidney cancer, whereas, you know, most guys who are community urologists, they do everything. And so their patient mix is different than ours. And, you know, it's not that their expertise is less or that they're anywhere less trained. It's just that my reps that I get on a certain procedure are probably going to be higher than somebody else who does everything. Whereas if you flip that around, if you ask me to take care of a prostate cancer patient, I really wouldn't know what to do in a lot of circumstances. So those are some of the bigger differences, I would say. It really allows us to really get granular and subspecialize. And I think the other thing is, you know, when you look at it, even if there was somebody in academics who does a little bit of everything, the support that we have, I think, is probably greater. You know, in our practice, for example, we have a residency program associated with it. So we have 15 residents available. That's a lot of labor support that we get. So things of taking care of patients, really complicated, really sick people who get admitted to the hospital are much easier to take care of for us. We can kind of rest assured at night that we can take on the train wrecks in the community and not end up really being too beat up over it.
That's awesome. So then kind of going off of that, why did you ultimately choose to go the academic route over the private practice route?
It's kind of funny how that worked out for me. I really wasn't going to do that originally. I did do a fellowship in female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery, and I was doing that to bolster my career, essentially, because coming out of where I trained, I didn't have a very robust experience with that. And I was hoping, I'm originally from the Chicago area, I was hoping to break back into that market. And so I wanted to bring a very well-rounded kind of total package back there And that was the one thing in my training that I was lacking originally. While in training, certain things happened, life events. I won't get into the nuts and bolts of that. And then the opportunity to work here came up, incredible job opportunity. And they were going to allow me to really focus on my area of subspecialty. And I jumped at it. It's been a great decision for me. Everything has been great since then.
So working with you in the past, you did like to kind of diversify the products, right? To kind of get those residents hands-on, see what they like for themselves, make their own opinions around what devices they use to treat their patients. Do you think that physicians are more likely to use the devices or the products that they did use in residency or fellowship?
I do think they would be, yes. At least the openness to do that. One of the big things I do is penile implants, which, listening to your past episodes, I love when you've brought on Sarah or Ed to talk about the wow factor of doing a penile implant surgery. It's an incredible operation. So I worked under Wayne Hellstrom, who was very adamant that the residents that worked under him learned both products that are available. He was very clear. He said, leave it up to you what you want to do ultimately in the future, but it's good that you are familiar with both, because both products do lend themselves differently to certain situations, I guess. And we're not here to talk about the product, of course, but I think it's good if the product seems good, if it has good data behind it. Obviously, it's FDA approved, and there's a lot of scrutiny to get through something like that. So I think it's worth exposing your trainees to everything for their benefit.
I completely agree. You know, I know the orthopedic world is so much different than the urology world. You know, you've got a handful of competitive products versus just the two. So it is nice that residents having that diversity kind of come up with their own perception of the product.
I think there's a myth out there in a lot of cases that there's this best product out there. I think the best product is the one that you are best at.
Absolutely.
And what you feel most comfortable with. I think that's really the important thing to drive home, especially when you're teaching somebody how to do something.
Oh, without doubt. What is your definition of a good rep? What attributes do you like to see out of your reps?
Do you have a mirror right in front of you somewhere?
Oh, wow. Okay. I did not pay him to say that.
There are several things. I think the thing that impresses me the most is somebody who has total command of their product in this case. You know, when you know every little bit of minutia of what's available that you have to offer, because, you know, you think it's like, oh, it's a penile implant or if it's an artificial sphincter when we're dealing with the prosthetics that you and I have worked with in the past. There are so many little subcomponents and parts to these things and differences in approach and accessory instruments that you need to aid in implantation, you know, like just the range of the amount of dilators, for example, that we use for a penile implant. It's not something that the average urologist even would be able to just reel off. And if they were put on the spot to tell you, you know, what they are, I'm not even sure I could right now, but that's probably because of it. But so a rep who knows their product stone cold like that is so helpful. I've been doing this for long enough that I consider myself relatively well experienced. I'm kind of a mid-career guy. But when I first started out, I really leaned heavily on the reps. And we were very fortunate to have a couple of really good ones out here that were able to lend their expertise. And then since I like to think a little bit, since you know, when you came out, you were relatively new, that hopefully I kind of taught you a few things doing the procedure and, you know, kind of little nuances and ins and outs of the operation that you could then carry forward to somebody else. So I think for reps to also, getting back to the question that you asked, knowledge of your product is very paramount, of course, but also knowing what the limitations of it are too, of course. You know, there's certain advantages and disadvantages to everything. Not over-promising on things, I think, is good. That's kind of a minor point. The other thing that I really like, and that you've been great in your current role, you are very quick to send me journal articles and literature and stuff that colleagues of mine around the country have done. I appreciate that so much, and it's not a real common thing. If you're kind of, you know, coming up in sales and you want a good pearl that would really impress, I think a lot of doctors, especially in academia, is have like a good core knowledge base and readily available articles that you can just, hey, I'm going to email you that right now and you can take a look at it. You know, I think that is so useful and so beneficial. And a lot of times, you know, from the benefit of what you're selling, that probably will get you customer. Whereas if you didn't provide that information, you might not.
Right. Well, having that transparency, I think, with your customers, and I love that you brought it up because, I mean, going to Mayo and working with you and the residents was, I mean, I told you this all the time, and now that I don't work for the company anymore, you know, I'm not just, you know, blowing smoke, but you guys really taught me, right? I used that opportunity to go in there and really learn because I didn't need to be there. I mean, you all knew what you had to do. You've done a number of these procedures. It was almost from a selfish standpoint that, hey, I can go and learn from these guys in an academic setting. And two, being a rep, again, from a selfish standpoint, for all of you new reps out there, there's so much value in becoming fully integrated into these residency programs, building genuine relationships with these residents. You have 4 or 5 years with them, right? You can be a big player in their continuing education. You know, maybe they do stay in your territory and hopefully you've built this relationship with them to now you're building your customer base, right? Which at the end of the day is going to help your quota. But, you know, you have that mutual respect there. And then even if they do go outside of your territory, they kind of look to you for guidance. Hey, do you have a referral out? One of your guys out in Florida right now, do you know anybody out there? Right? So you kind of really help them with that transition too, which I think is so much fun.
I totally agree with you on that. I think it's been great. I can think of, you know, one of our recent graduates, I think had to have been you at this point in time when he moved to St. Louis. I think you really, you know, got him hooked up with who he needed to be in contact with for that company. And, you know, I think that was very valuable to him. And for us to be able to allow that relationship to exist is really crucial for people, you know, moving on into practice and having success and, you know, having that comfort with something that they're used to dealing with and a friendly face at the other end when they make that journey out to, you know, when we kick them out of the nest, basically. I think that's really valuable for them. I don't want to segue just yet into kind of how things are now versus how they used to be, but we can talk about that in a little bit. But I think, you know, for having a relationship with our trainees, because, you know, there's a lot of times when you're setting up a case and you made the point that we don't always need you there. And that's just for the really straightforward stuff. But, you know, product support is huge in these cases sometimes. And, you know, if there's something that you just didn't have or a situation that for me, especially if it's like a redo case or something like that, I was like, oh my God, I really wish I had this. Right now, Grant's our guy now. Grant will run out to his car. He's got everything there. I'm amazed. Yep. I don't know. What I don't even know if he has room to sit. I mean, it's really impressive. And I guess this is another category that, or the trait that I would want to emphasize for people is resourcefulness. Being, you know, Johnny or Jane on the spot. But, you know, again, you were getting back to the training programs and stuff like that. I mean, you know, and you mentioning that you're learning from us at an academic institution, that's another piece of advice I would definitely give somebody who's new in sales is go watch, you know, I'm not putting myself in this category, but I'll let somebody else do that. But go watch the best of the best do it. Really go see somebody like me or Sean in town, do a few P&L implants, get some real good pointers and pearls from that. Watch what OR efficiency looks like. And, you know, you don't have to be pushy with that if you're with somebody who doesn't know that. But if they ask, you've got the answer right there. I think that's great.
I love that. I know this is a very high level question. Okay. And it doesn't necessarily apply to all surgeons. But I am curious, how do reps that don't currently have your business approach you and what approach tends to sit well with you?
So it's kind of funny. So if they don't have our business right now, it's obviously a product that I'm not using. That's not always something that can be helped. There are certain things that I'm coming from an institution where we're very data driven. Again, I'm going to go back to, it's nice if you have a scientific study in hand, be like, hey, this product can do X, Y, and Z in these situations. Don't make it a cure-all for something. Make it really like, where does your thing really shine? Situation X, Y, and Z, it's really good for this. Here's a couple of articles to support this. They don't have to be like, you know, high-level, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. I mean, you're never going to get that device stuff anyways, right? I mean, everybody knows what's going on. But you got to have the best data that you can come forward with. And so stuff that's published or publishable is really useful. And so I like to be approached with things like that. This is me. This is not everybody, of course, but I'm very open to meeting new people. I'm very open to new ideas. If you're not curious in academia, then you're probably not in the right field. You could say that for a lot of fields of life too. Just approaching somebody, it never hurts to ask. I can see this picture of Michael Jordan on your wall here right now. I think Wayne Gretzky actually said that, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Take those shots, you know, but don't be pushy and you're going to attract more people than you think you would.
And two, I think you bring up a good point. For those new sales reps out there, all you need is one case, right? So find that diabetic guy with poor tissue or that guy that has been radiated. You know, find those small percent cases, get your foot in the door, and then get the surgeon's hands on the product. And you never know what that could turn into for you.
Oh, totally. Exactly. Yeah. It's really good. And I think, you know, you can see it in somebody. They're knowledgeable. They come to you with good data. You know, if the product was approved, it's got to have good data somewhere. So just lead with that. I mean, I think that really helps. I've had experiences in the past where people just say, well, ours is the best because so-and-so said. And it's like, well, that doesn't really help me. You know, give me a little bit more than that.
Right. So, you know, kind of going off of the studies, right? There are a lot of studies out there. Mm-hmm. And just like you said, not every study is created equally. So what criteria do you look for in a good study? And then depending on that level of evidence, what is enough to sway you to give that product a shot?
So level of evidence, of course, the gold standard is, the double blind placebo controlled trial. I mean, you can't do that in surgery. I mean, it's really hard to do. There's certain things you can kind of fudge it a little bit, but pretty much people know. What you want is, things that are carefully constructed. They have validated outcome measures. Try to be as objective as possible, because a lot of what we deal with is so subjective, it becomes hard to really know what to believe in that case. One of the big things in urology, I'll pull from, the last, decade, 15 years or whatever, was kind of all the pelvic mesh stuff, that actually put a couple of companies out of business. I mean, big medical device companies had to go under because of all the things. And I think what happened was you were looking at, can this be done versus, is this making a difference? And I think it got a lot of people in trouble. And it's a very, it's a cautionary tale in medical devices, I think, that you really have to be wary of. That being said, it threw a lot of really good products under the bus as well, too. I mean, you think about the mid-urethral sling, which is probably the most well-studied surgical procedure in the entire world, in the history of medicine, and how demonized it is still right now. But yet, the alternatives are less effective, much more invasive, much more morbid, and yet people can't get around the fact that, if you use the M word, in this case in urology, it's mesh, patients are going to really clench up and back away from you and look at you a little strange. And so the reason is because the data was, it was all user defined. It's, the outcomes, the surgeons, oh, it was great. 90% great. well, says, according to what? Well, look at my note from, when this guy followed up, he's doing, or she's doing awesome. It's like, oh no, it's like, give me some scores, give me some outcomes, And I think that's really important for good studies. It's not like a medication when you're dealing with medical devices, medications, you can give somebody a pill that looks exactly like it, but it's just sugar. They take it and they think they're doing awesome. And it's just, I didn't give you anything, and it's one of those things, but you can't do that with surgery. So you have to go by measurables in that case. And so whenever you can throw those at somebody, that really helps a lot.
So I don't want to put you on the spot, but
all right.
I'm super excited for this. I really want to know what one of your funniest stories from working in the operating room is.
Okay. All right. I mean, I could go back. I think I was telling you and Scott earlier, I've been out of medical school for 20 years now. So between training and actually being in practice now, it's 20 years of experience I have. There are so many, of course, I'm a urologist and I trained in New Orleans, and so you can imagine the kind of crazy stuff that happened there. I'm going to go to a New Orleans story, and the reason is because I actually got injured in this surgery.
Oh, no.
No, it's funny. It's almost like a cartoon injury. So there was a gentleman who showed up, probably a little mental disturbance or whatever, but he put a metal ring around his penis, and it got stuck on there. So, like any guy does, he lives in denial with this and doesn't come in to seek care for about 3 days. So obviously there's a lot of edema, Fortunately, he did not lose his penis. I'll spoil the ending right there. We had to get this thing off of him still, and it was not coming off because everything beyond where he had stuck it on there was just all swollen. And it was not going to come off. So we had to cut this thing off somehow. Turns out it was a cast iron metal object. You look like you're going to throw up right now.
I see it in my head. It's just, this is not a good situation.
All right. So it's a cast iron, it turns out, is a material. And I didn't find that out until later. We decided that the best course of action was to try one of those orthopedic saws.
Okay.
And we burned through two blades on that.
Oh my God.
And we had him, we anesthetized the guy. He was asleep. And so we're just kind of going through this and that. We decided to get the head janitor of the hospital to find out what he's got available for him to cut something like this. And he takes a look, brought him into the operating room. He looks like he's ready to barf too. He had to put the white bunny suit on and he's got the mask on. He looks at that thing and he kind of says, this looks like it's a cast metal object. He says, what you need is a pair of bolt cutters. I said, really? He says, yeah. He's like, I got a big one down here. So he comes up with these bolt cutters, and these are used for cutting padlocks off and stuff like that. So we said, sure, we're game for that. He's like, well, I'm not doing it. You guys are going to have to do it. So it was the three of us. It was me, one of my junior residents at the time, and the attending surgeon. The first side, we put it up against there. We managed to kind of lubricate a tongue depressor, just a wooden stick, between the side of the guy's penis and the bolt cutters, just for safety purposes.
That's kind of you guys.
And we cut the first side of it. And since it was cast metal, you have to cut both sides. You have to cut two sides. So we go to cut the other side, and my junior resident and the attending physician, one of them's got the arms, and these bolt cutters are literally, I think they're probably about 3 feet off the floor. That's how long the arms are of these things. I'm steadying the end of this thing. They're each putting one arm of this into their bellies and they're hugging each other to try to, you know, pull themselves together to get enough force to actually do this thing. And, you know, they give me the 1, 2, 3, boom. Next thing I know, I'm on the floor. That metal part, when it got from the crush of the jaws of this thing breaking, it flew off and hit me in the forehead. So I am down on the ground. Like, it was like I said, this is like a cartoon injury. I'm seeing stars, like there's little birds flying around my head and stuff like that too. And obviously, you know, once they kind of figured out I was okay, everybody just started laughing. And I had like this like rectangle shaped bruise right between my eyes for about 2 weeks after that.
So oh, my goodness.
It was pretty good. But most of the urology bad story or funny stories from the OR have to do something with somebody doing something awful with their penis usually. So
that was one of my favorite questions to ask my surgeons. What's the craziest stuff you've seen, you know, trauma cases you get called in for? Ugh.
Oh, yeah. So that's probably my most memorable one, just because I know exactly where my mind was when it was 1, 2, 3, and then myself on the floor. Like, how did I get here right now? Just,
look at you now.
Yeah, here I am.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
So last but not least, you know, many of our listeners are either trying to break into medical sales or are currently in it. Do you have any parting words for them? You know, give a little bit of a surgeon perspective.
It's kind of funny because between you and new Sarah, as we'd like to call her, going through Boston Scientific, I got to see people at your stage in your career. I think what you guys bring is you have great enthusiasm. You're very personable. You guys are never pushy. You have great suggestions for, you know, even you guys have helped me with, you know, suggestions about tricky parts and cases or little, you know, subtle reminders, you know. But the thing is, you're not pushy. I think that's an important thing. I think, again, coming in with a strong knowledge base, just being supportive and really picking your moments to shine and recognizing when those are. And everybody has a little bit of a, you know, different gift as far as, you know, their ability to do that. I think being able to do that is really key. For certain things, it's persistence as well, too. I mean, we get back to the, you're not going to succeed if you don't try. I think that's very important. But there's a fine line between what you guys do, acquiring new customers, and then supporting the ones you have. You have to have your both feet in each of those worlds. And it's or one foot in each world, but it's more than that. You want to be everything to that person who is relying on you for whatever support you're supposed to be there giving. And that's, I think, my biggest take home from that, I think, would be to be there and be available. And there's so many other things that, you know, that can come from that. You know, what stage you are in your personal growth, your emotional intelligence, really work on that. I mean, in any field that's a, you know, real person-driven field, you have to have good emotional intelligence. So work on that. If you don't know what that is, that's probably a subject for an entire other podcast. But it's important. It's important. And you'll run into a lot of surgeons who don't have very good emotional intelligence. So, you know, you just need to be able to get that. Knowing how to read a room. Now, we're both Midwesterners. We're great at that. Just those little intangibles that you can bring to the table is just something that you cannot be overlooked when you're developing yourself.
I love that. That is all just such great advice for both people that are just starting out and people that are developed in their careers, right? Because it's so easy to just get caught up in your day-to-day and you forget to do the little things. And it's those little things that are going to provide so much value to your customers and to the patients.
I would agree.
Dr. Walter, thank you so much for taking the time to jump on here with me. I think kind of our wide array of listeners can all benefit from everything you've discussed. You know, as reps, it's so important for us to understand that private and academic practices do function a little bit differently. And, you know, it can have a large impact on our sales and on the approach we take. So thank you for coming on here. You know, your wisdom, your candidness is always appreciated. I think our listeners will greatly benefit from it.
Well, thank you very much. And I wish you and Scott all the success in the world with this podcast. I think it's great. Doing my homework for coming on here too, I really, truly enjoyed listening to this. And to see you guys do this, especially, you know, for you, I'm just really proud of you, actually. This is great.
Oh, you're going to make me cry. Thanks, Dr. Walter.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm going to take off, as we will after every episode, with a very sincere thank you for tuning in and a few words to carry with you and keep with you in the back of your mind. The mediocre teacher tells. The good teacher explains. The superior teacher demonstrates. The great teacher inspires.